All right, we're going to be in Exodus 24, and we're going to try to get through 24, 25, 26, and 27. Go up to 28, and this is going to be all about the instructions for building the tabernacle and kind of everything that's going to be involved in making and preparing kind of the sacrificial system. And so this is the part of Exodus where if you've been, you know, on your own Bible reading, getting through the plan, this is where many people start to lose steam and skip ahead and then skip past Leviticus and keep going on. But what I want us to see here as we are looking at this is that, one, everything they build is patterned on what Moses and what the 70 elders and Joshua see in heaven. They're not just building something because God gave them some instructions. They're going to have a vision of what is happening in heaven and what the tabernacle is there. And then God will tell them, here's how you can build it down here. And then they'll do that. So over and over, we'll have phrases repeated about build it based on what you saw on the mountain. That'll kind of get repeated. So that's one thing we need to keep in mind. The other thing is that there is a specific way that God must be worshipped. And the specifics and the details matter. They can't build whatever kind of tabernacle they want. Can't build whatever kind of altar they want. You can't just approach worship to God however you want it to be. Even now, on this side of the cross and after Jesus, it's still the way we worship Jesus matters. And the way we approach God in worship matters. And the details, and even the specifics matter too. We don't just get to do whatever we want. And so that's one of the things we need to, two things to keep in your mind is, one, it's all based on something that's happening in heaven. So, I mean, if you're getting a picture of what's in heaven, that's pretty cool. I think we should care about that. And God cares about it, so we should. The other thing to keep in mind is that we really don't have any idea exactly what this stuff looked like. After the temple was destroyed, especially in 70 AD, we just don't know anymore. You can Google stuff, you can look at a lot of different pictures. I'll have some up there. But it's guesses and interpretations, and there may be many different ones. The closest that we know to how some of it actually looked is this picture right here, which is from the arch of Titus, who was a Roman emperor who destroyed Israel and destroyed the temple. And this is celebrating them sacking the temple and taking everything out of it. And so it looks like part of it. I think maybe that's the ark. There's the lampstand. There's some of the other stuff. So what did it look like? That's as close as we kind of know for sure, because it's about 10 years this was made after, in 81 AD. But anyway, getting into it. So the covenant is read. God comes down and says to Moses, come up to the Lord, not just him, but Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and 70 of the elders from Israel, and worship from afar. Moses alone can come near to the Lord. The others cannot come near, and the people can't come up with them. So there's this kind of dual thing that's happening. All of the elders are going up with Moses and Joshua and Aaron so that he can see what is going on here and see the instructions that God is giving. But Moses is the only one who is allowed to come and draw near to God and be close. So they get to see some of it, but they don't get to have the same relationship with God that Moses has. And while they're there as well, and afterwards Moses comes, they all hear it, then they all come down, and Moses tells the people all of the words of the Lord and all of the rules. So he doesn't just say, hey, God's got some laws for us. He reads it all. He tells them every single one. And then the people respond and say, yes, all that the Lord says we'll do. And Moses writes it all down, and then the next morning he wakes up, they build an altar, they sacrifice. Moses takes blood, and then he takes the book that he just, you know, wrote and just read, and he reads it all again. So they hear all of the law, all of the covenant, twice. Two times. Okay, if you went to seminary, they would tell you that's really bad preaching, that's bad rhetoric. Don't do that. Just summarize, you know. But no, Moses reads it all twice. Why? It's really important that they hear it and that they get it. I think that's part of the significance of Hebrews 10:21, where it tells us that, you know, because of Jesus, we can now draw near to the throne of grace. And James 4:8, you know, says, draw near to the Lord and he will draw near to you. The fact that we can draw near to God because of Jesus is incredibly significant, because the elders couldn't at this point yet, but now we can. And then after this happens, they make the sacrifices, they read it, they still, you know, they twice say that we're going to do it. Moses takes blood and he throws it on the people. It says, behold the covenant, the blood of the covenant that God has made with you. Because the covenant has to be sealed in blood. And so there's this sense that they are covered with it as well, and kind of being anointed by it. Their sins being forgiven or dealt with in some way here. And then after this, there's a lot that happens here in these next, kind of here from the end, where chronologically it's not always clear. Is this like bouncing back and forth? How many times is Moses going up and down the mountain? I don't really know that it's that important to put it all together exactly. But when they're all up there and all the elders, they saw the God of Israel. They see him, and under his feet it was like a pavement of sapphire stones, like the very heaven for clearness. But God didn't lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel, and they beheld God, and they ate and drank. These are an incredible two verses, or three, just in 9 from 11. They get to see God. And in 11 it says he doesn't lay hands on them. He's saying he didn't kill them. They get to see God, and God allowed it. He could have killed them, and yet he did not. He showed grace here. And it's not that they got to, you know, see all of God. They got to see at least an outline, a shape, some glimmer, some glimpse of who God is. And the pavement, the sapphire stones being there, it really does seem as if not just like a vision of heaven, but that heaven itself comes and reveals itself here on this mountain. As if it, I hesitate to try and say, oh, you know, it comes down like an elevator. But it's as if heaven really physically appears and they see it and they behold God in that place. And what happens here, especially the pavement of sapphire stones and the way this is described, seems very similar to Ezekiel 1. When Ezekiel goes and he has a vision of heaven and he gets to see God and the four cherubim that are around him, or Isaiah 6, where Isaiah as well has a similar vision. It seems like that starts here, that the 70 elders get to see this kind of vision. But God doesn't kill them. They behold him, and then they get to eat and they drink. It's not just they're having a picnic lunch. It is they're eating and drinking with God. They're having communion. They're sharing a meal with God the Father. Certainly foreshadowing what happens later with getting to eat with Jesus. And then after Moses, again, he goes up another time and he gets the law written down, this time in stone, the law and the commandment. And he goes up there with Joshua, who goes up on the mountain, and they wait. And they say, hey, we're going to be gone for a while, so, you know, talk to Aaron or her if anyone has a dispute. And so then as they go up, the glory of the Lord dwells on the mountain and covers it for 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called Moses out of the midst of the cloud, and the glory of the Lord was like devouring fire. And Moses entered the cloud and went up, and then Moses is on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. It's so glorious that, you know, everyone who's around sees it and is kind of in wonder by it. But we see Joshua already, God preparing him and God choosing him. It's not like he was Moses' favorite person, or that's how it happened. God's the one who's choosing this. But Joshua gets to see some of what's happening as well. And then while they're there, part of this 40 days and 40 nights of instruction, God says, speak to the people of Israel. They may take up for me a contribution. And every man whose heart moves him, you shall receive a contribution from me. And that this is what you shall get: gold, silver, bronze, blue, purple, scarlet yarns, fine twirled linen, goat's hair, tanned ram skins, goat skins, acacia wood, oil for the lamp, spices for the anointing oil, fragrant incense, onyx stone, stones for setting, an ephod, and a breastpiece. God's got a big list of what they can bring. Now, first, this is an offering. So this is not the tithe. There are several different tithes, or you could call them taxes. I hesitate to call it that when it's something that God requires. Gifts that God does require regularly. This isn't that. This is just, hey, we're getting ready to build the tabernacle. We're going to build the stuff that you just saw up in heaven. We need things for it. Tell Israel what we need, and then whoever wants to bring it can come and bring it. But the importance is whoever their heart moves them to receive this contribution. So it's meant to be given freely, which matches much of what happens later in the New Testament as well, as, hey, you know, as your heart moves you, give. Should their heart move them? Yes. Who should give? Yes, all of them. would be the right response. It would be weird if they were like, ah, I don't know. You can give. I don't think I need to. That would be strange. You know, God is allowing them to do it freely, and their response to his grace should be to give. But there's a lot of things. All of them are going to be used. Many of them are expensive things. The gold, the silver, purple and scarlet yarns would be incredibly rare. Some of these are exotic things. So God is asking for things that would be costly. But there's also things that aren't as costly for those who maybe don't have some of these things, just oil. We need oil. We need spices. We need rocks. So everybody has the ability to give and to participate. And many of these things as well, they were just slaves in Egypt for a long time. How would they have this? Well, they just plundered Egypt. Remember when they left Egypt and everyone was just giving them stuff? They said, hey, go ask and they'll just give you gold. And many of these things that God's asking for now, they're already given from by the Egyptians. Why would they have done that? Because God knew he was going to ask them to build a tabernacle. So that's kind of why that worked out that way. So after they get these things, he then says, oh yeah, 9. Exactly as I show you concerning the pattern of the tabernacle and all of its furnishings, so shall you make it. So they've got to make this based on what Moses sees in heaven. But so then they're supposed to make the ark. And I'm not going to read everything exactly on how they're supposed to make the ark or what it's supposed to be. But the ark is going to be the most important part of the tabernacle. That's why it starts first. Because this will be the place where in the tabernacle God's presence will dwell and where he will be. Again, you can find a bunch of different pictures of artists' renditions or guesses of what it looks like, you know, or Indiana Jones. But it's mostly a box, and on the top it has the cherubim, right, who are both facing each other. They're covering with wings. You know, sometimes you see people and they're like cute little babies. But then when you read Ezekiel and you read Ezekiel 1, you read Isaiah 6, they sound a little more intimidating than, you know, cute little cherubs. They seem scarier. And they're there, which is significant too, because the cherubim are mentioned in Eden. They're there. They help guard the garden after man is being cast out. And the cherubim are the ones who are in heaven, who are surrounding God's throne and surrounding his presence. So they are here on the ark symbolically, because that's where they always are. They're around where God is, to worship him, to protect him, keep us out. You know, I don't know, but they're there. So that's why they're kind of important. And the top of it, in 17, you know, it's your translation may differ on what it calls it. The cover, the lid, the mercy seat is the most common phrase we use a lot, which is good. It could also be atonement cover. It would be another accurate kind of translation. It's where the atonement is going to take place, where they will actually put the blood on the Day of Atonement on top of the lid right there. And there's nothing on it. Okay, the angels, the cherubim are bowing down. There's not then a picture of God or an idol of God or an image of God. There's nothing there, right? Why? Because we are not and we cannot and should not make images of God and shouldn't make idols of them. This is what's going to get Aaron and them in trouble when they make the golden calf. But so there's not supposed to be anything there. And it's also interesting to note, I saw somebody point this out, inside the ark, that's where they're going to put the stones that God is going to write. They're going to put the law and the covenant. And then there will be the lid, and they will put the blood on it, and then there is God's presence. So there really is already this sense and this idea that we're going to fail the law, and the law is not going to be good enough, and we have to be covered with blood. So that when God, you know, he looks down, he doesn't see all of our failures. He sees the blood of the covenant, I think is some of what's happening there. So then after the Ark of the Covenant, he mentions the table for bread, or the showbread. So it tells him to make just a table. It's pretty small. It's really kind of about the size of a coffee table, give or take. And they're on top of this is supposed to be bread. 12 loaves, one loaf of bread for every tribe in Israel. And it is supposed to be there to be in God's presence. They're also supposed to have poles like the Ark of the Covenant. So, you know, they have rings and poles so they can carry it as they're traveling. And the bread has to be there, and they set the bread of the presence on the table before him regularly. And God will give more instructions about this in Leviticus. You can read more detail kind of about how that is to be. But it's never supposed to go stale. It's always to be fresh. And so, you know, there's Many other religions, you know, will make offerings to God and bring food to their gods and bread and meat and all these other things. We know we're not giving this to God because he's hungry and because he likes fresh bread and he needs to eat it. So there's something else that's going on here. I think it's meant to be a reminder of God's daily provision for them, how he will provide their daily bread. As he is every day in the wilderness, or as they're traveling now and as they'll travel later, the 40 years in the wilderness, they'll have manna every single day. Every day God will provide. And so every day they make bread, and they don't need to make their bread first. They need to make the bread for God first and put it there. There's some later Jewish traditions as well, which who knows how they actually did it, that they wouldn't take all 12 off and then put all 12 back on. They would take one, you know, stale loaf off at a time and put one more back on it so that it would regularly always be in God's presence, which makes sense. It seems like that would fit. And this makes me think too, later in communion, when Jesus takes the bread and he breaks it and then he eats it and he gives it to his disciples. So then there's the sense where it's not just bread that's there and it's God's and it's just symbolic of his provision or his presence or something. It's no, here, Jesus takes the bread and now we can eat with him as the elders ate and Moses ate up on the mountain. And we get the lampstand. So this picture should be somewhat familiar. You know, menorahs, if you've seen those around Hanukkah or anything, are really kind of based off of what we think this lampstand looked like. And God describes the lampstand. They're to make a lampstand of pure gold, of hammered wood. And it really is actually supposed to be out of one talent, which is about 75 pounds of pure gold. So this is not like a little thing you could just carry around or put on your nightstand. This is meant to be serious, heavy, weighted, durable, and it's meant to last for a very long time. And it has these many branches. There needs to be 6 branches going out from the sides, 3 branches to one side, 3 to the other. And there's also supposed to be these little almond cups that are meant to kind of hold the fire and also hold part of the oil. And so it seems like it's meant to be, to kind of look like a tree. Scholars debate, is it supposed to look like an almond tree because the cups are meant to be like almond flowers? Or is it supposed to be an olive tree? Because both of those are used throughout the Old Testament in various images. God uses them a lot in the prophets. Don't really know, not sure that it matters, but it certainly looked like a tree, which, you know, maybe would have made them think of the tree of life in the garden, or I don't know what would have made them think like it, but God wanted it to look this way. And this lamp was really, you know, meant to be in the, give light to the space in front of it. It would have helped make a lot of light. Okay, it probably would have been the brightest part of the tabernacle, and it would have shined a lot. It would have, you know, probably lit up the tent and help it stand out among all of the other tents that are there, I imagine. So they have the lampstand, then the tabernacle itself, and the tabernacle is kind of all of chapter 26, which just has lots of instructions on all of these different curtains and all of the different things involving it, and there are many different curtains. There's many different layers of it. There's an outer layer, so the layer that most people would see is meant to be like more tough, like the goat hair, and more of just animal hides and not the ornate and not the beautiful part. That's just meant to be the outside from the elements, because they're traveling and they're tearing this thing down, they're putting it back up, and the wind is blowing and there's dirt, there's all sorts of other things, and so that's meant to, you know, be more protective on the outside. And then inside of it is where the more ornate and the purple and the decorated robes or curtains kind of are meant to be. But they are really, really big. But the significance of the tabernacle is, again, it's a piece of heaven on earth, and it is meant to be the place where God dwells among them. This is why God tells them to make it, because this is going to be where I dwell, where I come and live. Just as they're traveling and they all have their tents, hey, where do you live? I'm in that tent over here. Where is God? He's in that tent right there. And so it's meant to be just a physical reminder of God's presence and the place where he lives and is. It's also a reminder, because part of what's happening too is so far the only place that they have seen God is on Mount Sinai. Now Moses has seen God. He saw him in the burning bush, but he also saw him on Mount Sinai. But now God is not going to stay on the mountain. It's not that that mountain is the only place where their God is, and now they're going to go far away into the promised land. It's God, hey, he's in the tent, and the cloud, later we'll see the cloud will descend on it, and then when it's time to go, the cloud will go up, and they pack up the tent, and they roll it up, and they pick up the ark, and they move, and then they set it back up, and the cloud's going to come back down. It's God goes with them wherever they go, because, yes, God lives here, but it's not his, you know, it's not the only place that he lives. He can move, which to us is, you know, duh, of course. We know God can move. He's everywhere. Why would they think that? Well, in their culture and in this time period, gods were geographically trapped. They were gods of one place, of one nation, of one temple, not our God. And he dwells among them. And so there's the duller outer layer, and then there's also, you know, the Holy of Holies, where they have big curtain set up in front of it, and there's no split in the curtain. There's no door in the curtain, and they're meant to kind of pull it tight so that you can't act. Ooh, sorry, I accidentally stumbled into the Holy of Holies and looked at the ark. And that wouldn't have happened. Okay, you would have had to work hard to get in there, which is all part, also, you know, as we know, when Jesus died on the cross, and that curtain tears from top to bottom. That moment wouldn't have as much meaning if there was already a split there that they could open every now and then. But that happened to show, hey, now we can go into God's presence. And not just that we can go into God's presence, but his presence comes out, and it can be everywhere. But the Holy of Holies is meant to be, you know, a significant, special place. And there is where, you know, they put the ark and the law, and all of that is meant to be behind it. And the only place that they can, the only one who can go in there is the high priest once a year. He can do that, but nobody else can. Then we have the altar. They make a bronze altar of wood, and they have four horns on it on the corners, just a square. Make some pots, some other utensils that they need to use, and some grating. And then there's nothing supposed to be in it. It needs to be hollow, and needs to be able to carry it. Again, you can get a lot of different pictures. Something kind of like this, because it's meant to kill animals on and then to burn them. So it really is... It's an altar. I don't want to say it's like a grill, but you know they're tending a fire underneath it, which is why there's nothing in the middle. The horns on the corner are, you know, to help hold animals in place so they don't roll away. Probably, you can find all sorts of different symbols in them. You know, oh, it's the four gospels or virtues or who knows. I don't know about all that. Maybe. But part of it too, later when we'll read about the laws of refuge or the cities of refuge, or even you read, especially in Samuel and Kings, there'll be times where people go and they flee and they grab a hold the horns of the altar for mercy, or for justice, asking for God's salvation, that they would not be killed even though they should be. And when it talks about that, that's what they're grabbing onto. They're grabbing onto the corners where those horns are. So God had some purpose for why he wanted that to be. And this is the only place that the sacrifices are meant to really take place here, is that this altar in the tabernacle at this place. They're not supposed to be building lots of different altars. Let's just sacrifice where we want. We can all have our own altars at home. No, this is the one. And it's meant to go with them. It's also, there's not steps going up to it, or there shouldn't be. This one kind of chose a ramp. A lot of the other ones I saw had a bunch of steps. We read before the last lock. I said, don't do that when you build altars. So one of that, then there's the court of the tabernacle, which is kind of their, they then build a fence all the way around, which is something we'll see repeated when they build the temple as well. They'll have a couple different kinds of courts. This one doesn't seem to have multiple courts. There's not a men's court and a female court or a Gentile court and then the Jewish court. It's just one big court outside. And this is, you know, where people can come. Only the priests get to go inside of the tabernacle. Only the high priest gets to go inside the Holy of Holies once a year. But all the people get to come and be in the court. They can all come and worship inside. And it's meant to be large. It's meant to have a big assembly. or a congregation, or for where everyone can gather for corporate worship. And often when the Psalms, you know, especially David when he's singing about stuff, you know, before the temple is built, and he's saying, you know, one day in your courts is better than thousands elsewhere, this is the court that he's talking about. Is just standing inside that fence looking at the tabernacle, looking at the tent. And so this is meant to be the place of worship. Then we have the oil for the lamp, which is kind of interesting that it comes, you know, later after a lot of this stuff. But he commands the people of Israel that they bring you beaten olive oil for the light, that a lamp may be regularly set up to burn. And the tent of meeting, and outside the veil that's before the testimony, Aaron and his sons, so this would be, you know, the priest, the Levitic priests, tend it from evening to morning before the Lord. And it's a statute forever to be observed throughout the generations by the people of Israel. Again, no idea what this looks like. This doesn't seem to be the golden lampstand, I think. I mean, maybe it is, but it seems like it's another lamp that's meant to be burning. If you ever go into a Jewish synagogue, or if you've been in one, you will usually see some kind of torch that is up, usually in front or somewhere, and it probably won't actually have fire in it, but will be red or have a light on it. It's usually this, kind of the eternal flame, kind of a symbolic or a reminder and rendition of that. So some kind of lamp that is supposed to burn all of the time. And people can, and they are, supposed to bring oil so that the lamp can keep burning. That's not just a one-time thing, because if it's supposed to burn forever, that's a lot of oil that you're going to continually need all the time. This is also a much more manageable thing that people can bring. Because it's assuming, too, almost everybody's going to have this. They're going to have their own lamps, going to have their own torches, they're going to need light. So it's, hey, come bring some to the Lord. And I think there's some beauty in that as well. Of the even someone who is poor who has some can take it, can bring it to the tabernacle and know that their oil will get used as well before God as a sacrifice. And so it burns, and it's supposed to burn before the testimony, being the testimony, the law, the commandments. It's always referring just to the covenant and all of God's rules. But why does he do this? It's not just like the Olympic flame. I love when the Olympic flame gets, you know, lit at the games, and they carry it, you know, all the way from Greece, and all it's fun, and they put it out at the end. It's meant to be something a little more than that. You know, especially when you live in a place like this, okay, they don't have street lights. They don't have city lights that are just always on. You just have your torches, your family's oil, you know, your lamp. And then when you're going to sleep, you're putting it out because you don't want to, you know, burn your tent down and then you don't have anything. And so people can look and say, hey, okay, they're asleep. And as the day would go and the evening would go, all the lamps are going to go out, except in one place. The tabernacle will always be lit. And part of that is symbolic, I think, to show, hey, God is home. And God is not asleep. He's always awake. He's always watching. He's always there over them. So I don't think it's just meant to be something that they continually do for God. I think it's also meant to be a symbol and a reminder that their God is with them, that he doesn't sleep. He doesn't get tired and, you know, need a break, like I need a break for my children because I get exhausted sometimes. No, he's always there. And so that's what this is kind of meant to be. So what do we do with all this? One, I think it's just a good reminder that this is a preview of what we will get to see in heaven, or the new heavens and the new earth. It's not necessarily that the sacrifice will be making sacrifices again, but this existed already. And so we're just getting a sneak peek of what it looks like. I'm sure it'll look much better there. And also, everything we see here really is a preview of what we will see in Jesus. You know, Jesus, the cross, the gospel, our salvation, the resurrection. It doesn't make any sense without the law at all. It's just random and weird, but the law leads up to it, and the law explains it. And so even as we go through, I just pointed out some of these places, but simple ideas like, hey, we can draw near to God. Oh, hey, Jesus took bread and he broke it and he gave it to his disciples and he shared it with them. And, oh, people got to come and eat with Jesus. And sinners were welcome to come and be around Jesus. Those things are really significant. And we notice their significance when we see what was set up first here. And also, I think it's just a good reminder that the smallest matters of worship really matter to God. The exact measurements of the curtain mattered. The material that they used mattered. Now, it does seem like he gives freedom in some places. Could they have added some decorations on the altar? Yep. There seems to be places on the curtain where he says, you know, like, hey, you can, you know, add some ornateness to this. So what did they put on there? Don't know. Maybe they let art, God let artists decide, give them some freedom. But there's still rules. There's still guidelines. And so, you know, it's not, I don't know. To me, it's an encouraging reminder that the way we worship God matters even in the small things. And on one hand, that can be convicting to realize where we've been careless in our worship or careless in our following of God, and that should be. On the other hand, it should be encouraging as well to be like, oh, even the smallest ways that we worship God, even the smallest ways we walk in obedience matter and are significant. So that's my shot at explaining that. But any questions on anything on the tabernacle, the ark, any of these things? Don't ask me where the ark is. I don't know. It's probably nowhere. Or God just took it back up to heaven. Okay. Well, let me pray for us, and then elders, we're going to have a short meeting when Mike is done, if he's not already. God, I thank you. I thank you for giving us a preview of what is in heaven. Lord, that we don't have to just wonder. I mean, there is a mysteriousness, and there's a blessing, and there's a wonder of what it will be. But you give us a preview. You give us trailers, and you get to see a sneak peek of what it looks like. And I also praise you that through Jesus, through the blood of Christ, through his death, his life, his resurrection, his ascension, that now we get to draw near to you. That we get to come as a body, and we get to break bread and to drink with you in your presence. And what a profound, incredible blessing that is. And would you help us to realize that as we read your word, especially as we read the Mosaic Covenant, where we continue to go through Exodus, would you just show us what an incredible blessing that Jesus is and that you bring. We pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen. All right. Thanks for being here tonight.